From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
There is some mystery and some fear concerning three of the civil rights workers, two whites from New York City and a Negro from Mississippi. Police say they arrested the three men for speeding yesterday, but released them after they posted bond. They have not been heard from since.
As the Justice Department announces it's closed nearly half its investigations into unresolved killings from the civil rights era, we look back at the murders of James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, the subject of the new documentary Neshoba, The Price of Freedom. We'll speak with the brothers of two of the men, Ben Chaney and David Goodman. We'll look at some of the other unresolved civil rights murder cases with journalist Jerry Mitchell in Jackson, Mississippi.
As a result of their dragging the Mississippi River, nine additional bodies, other than the three civil rights workers, were pulled out of the Mississippi River. And for those of us in Mississippi, people began to ask, who are these nine people?
We'll also speak with Bruce Watson about Freedom Summer, the savage season that made Mississippi burn and made America a democracy. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge has granted a temporary stay of his ruling striking down California's gay marriage ban known as Proposition 8. On Thursday, U.S. District Court Chief Judge Vaughn Walker said gay marriage opponents have until next Wednesday to seek an appeals court ruling on whether to block gay marriages while his repeal of the ban is appealed. In Los Angeles, West Hollywood Pro Tem Mayor John Duran announced the decision to a crowd of gay marriage supporters.
We've just received information from the federal court in San Francisco that Judge Walker has said the marriages cannot begin until August the 18th at 5 o'clock p.m.
No.
So those couples who are in lines at county offices, it looks like you're going to have to wait another week. Some of you have waited 5, 10, 20 years. Going to have to wait another week. We cannot start performing marriages until August the 18th at 5 o'clock in the evening.
Although several gay rights groups called Walker's ruling a victory, some same-sex couples criticized the delay. Los Angeles residents Robin Tyler and Diane Olson said they're disappointed that the wait will continue.
Sad. You know, sad. It's an emotional roller coaster. I'm sorry that they stayed the marriages for a week, because I'm sure that the opposition is going to go to a higher court and try to stop it. And, you know, for what reason? It's very disappointing. Very
mad. I am thoroughly disgusted.
In issuing the temporary stay, Judge Walker said he doubts gay marriage opponents will prevail in their appeal of his ruling because they haven't shown how they'd be affected by its implementation. By contrast, Walker said same-sex couples are being denied their constitutional rights every day the ban's in place. Jeff Zarrillo, a plaintiff in the lawsuit against Proposition 8, said he's hopeful the appeal will be denied.
I totally understand that, and I can certainly understand people's emotions, but we have to keep the end game in sight, and the end game is a full federal equality for all gay and lesbian Americans, and we're confident we'll get there.
A CNN poll released this week shows a majority of Americans support same-sex weddings, with 52% saying they think gay and lesbians have a constitutional right to marriage. The number of claims for first-time unemployment benefits has reached its highest level in 6 months. On Thursday, the Labor Department said over 484,000 initial jobless claims were filed in July, the most since the week ending February 20th. New figures, meanwhile, show foreclosures increased 9% last month to 93,000. That's also a 6% increase over the same period a year ago. Amid some of the worst economic news in weeks, a new report predicts Wall Street bonuses will likely increase for the second straight year. The compensation consultant Johnson Associates says firms will see bonus hikes of up to 15%, surpassing 2009 levels. The oil giant BP has been fined $50.6 million for ongoing safety hazards stemming from a deadly 2005 explosion that killed 15 workers and injured 180 others at its Texas City, Texas refinery. The penalty comes on top of an $87 million fine against BP last year for failing to make safety improvements earlier this year. The refinery accidentally released an estimated 538,000 pounds of toxic chemicals. Alabama's attorney general has filed two lawsuits accusing BP and other companies of neglecting their responsibility for the Gulf Coast oil disaster. The separate lawsuits allege that BP, as well as other firms, including Transocean and Halliburton, have damaged Alabama's economy and environment through, quote, negligent or wanton failure to adhere to recognized industry standards. The suits seek unspecified economic and punitive damages. Over 300 federal lawsuits have been filed in 12 states against BP and the other main companies involved in the disaster. Congress has given final approval to a $600 million measure to increase militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border. On Thursday, the Senate approved the bill with just two members present, Democrats Chuck Schumer of New York and Ben Cardin of Maryland. Schumer and Cardin interrupted their summer recess to advance the bill after a congressional procedure held it up. Schumer said the measure would help fight violence and drug trafficking.
I come to the floor to seek unanimous consent to pass a smart, tough, and effective $600 million bill that will significantly enhance the security and integrity of our nation's border, which currently lacks the resources needed to fully combat the drug smugglers, gun runners, human traffickers, money launderers, and other organized criminals that seek to do harm to innocent Americans along our border.
The spending will fund around 1,500 new border agents and law enforcement officials, as well as two aerial surveillance drones. The bill now goes to President Obama, who is expected to sign it into law. The vote comes on the heels of a poll this week showing the majority of residents in U.S. towns bordering Mexico feel their communities are safe. The group that commissioned the poll, the Border Network for Human Rights, says it's the first independent survey of border town residents. Over 86% of respondents said they feel safe in their daily activities, and nearly 70% said they feel they're as safe as in any community in the United States. In a statement, Fernando Garcia of the Border Network for Human Rights said, quote, "It's time to rethink our border policy by increasing the quality and accountability of border enforcement, not the quantity of armed agents and soldiers." A group of U.S. Congress members has asked the State Department to explore ways to end U.S. responsibility and financing for a program to compensate Iraqi victims of U.S. attacks. USAID AID Director Christopher Crowley said the U.S. has already asked Iraq to make a larger contribution to the fund. Iraq's top military commander, meanwhile, continues to warn his troops won't be ready for a planned U.S. withdrawal next year. Speaking at a military conference in Baghdad, Lieutenant General Babaker Zebari repeated his contention that the Iraqi armed forces will need U.S. backing until 2020.
The U.S. military will be here for advice and backing, but in very special cases they will be ready to defend the Iraqi army because they control the Iraqi spaces, as our air force is not complete yet. The U.S. has 50,000 actual combat troops, but the problem will be after 2011, so we have to work with the Americans, the West, or the regional countries, because the Iraqi army will be ready in 2020.
The Pentagon's continuing to warn WikiLeaks about releasing more classified Afghan war records on top of the initial 76,000 it published last month. On Thursday, WikiLeaks said it's about halfway through preparing the remaining 15,000 documents for release. In response, Pentagon spokesperson Jeff Morrell said publishing the new documents would be, quote, the height of irresponsibility and would harm U.S. forces, U.S. allies, and Afghan civilians. Israel's rejected a new Palestinian offer to base peace talks on establishing a Palestinian state along the 1967 borders. The proposal was based on a statement from the Middle East Quartet of the U.S., UN, the European Union, and Russia earlier this year that also called for a freeze on West Bank settlements and on home demolitions in East Jerusalem. But Israel's refused to accept any preconditions that could scale back its control of the West Bank. Palestinian Authority advisor Mohammed Schleicher criticized Israel's stance.
It's a pity that such a pressure is directed to the Palestinian Authority rather than it should be directed fully and totally against and towards the Israeli government. The Palestinian Authority, President Abu Mazen, has actually made everything possible for a successful peace talks. Israel has not offered anything, neither a good environment for peace, i.e. to totally freeze all the Jewish settlements, and on top of all, Israel has not accepted a clear terms of reference for the peace talks.
That's Palestinian Authority advisor Mohammed Shdeya. Despite promises to engage more forcefully in peace efforts, the Obama administration's reportedly rejected two Palestinian requests to take a key role in the talks. Palestinians say the U.S. turned down their proposals to host a meeting between them and Israel on establishing a framework for talks, and a separate proposal for President Obama to issue a statement outlining the U.S. stance on what the framework should be, as President Bill Clinton did in late 2000. Pakistani officials are warning the province of Sindh is facing floods that could be as destructive as the first round that displaced millions of people. Rising waters in a nearby river could overrun the surrounding embankments and flood the area. More than 1,600 people have died since the floods began over 2 weeks ago. A group of British-based Pakistani journalists held a protest in London Thursday to call attention to what they say is a media crackdown by the Pakistani government. At least two news outlets have faced recent attacks after running criticism of Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari's decision to continue with a foreign trip as the floods hit. This is the Pakistani journalist and attorney Abid Hussain.
They've clamped down on a number of media outlets and shut them down so we can't expose the bad governance and all the issues that are happening with regards to the lack of governance and the lack of help for these flood victims, and of course trying to portray what's actually the true sentiment and feelings of the overseas Pakistanis and the Pakistanis at home. So this protest is actually against the government, against Zardari, against civilian dictatorship, in order to ensure that we have a free and democratic media in Pakistan and overseas.
Burma's military junta has announced it'll hold the country's first elections in two decades on November 7th. The main Burmese opposition party, the National League for Democracy, has already said it'll boycott the vote because the junta has barred the pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi and all other current or former political prisoners from running. The Canadian Navy has intercepted a ship carrying nearly 500 Tamils in the province of British Columbia. The ship's passengers are hoping to stay in Canada after fleeing Sri Lanka, which ended a nearly three-decade civil war with Tamil rebels last year. Canada's public safety minister called some of the passengers, quote, suspected human smugglers and terrorists. In a statement, the group No One Is Illegal urged the Canadian government to accept the Tamils, saying, quote, they've survived a long and arduous journey in the hopes the Canadian state will fully comply with its international obligations to the right to asylum. In Haiti, dozens of protesters held a sit-in at the National Palace Thursday to oppose the forced evictions of thousands of displaced residents from makeshift camps. The Haitian government's been urged to issue a moratorium on all forced evictions until alternative shelter options can be provided. And a New York woman has filed a civil rights lawsuit against the New York Police Department over a beating at a lesbian party last year. Tiffany Jimenez says officers yelling homophobic slurs assaulted her and another lesbian of color outside a Brooklyn bar in May of 2009. In a statement, Jimenez said, quote, this lawsuit can't take away the violence I suffered, and it won't give me back the months that it's taken to recover, yet I hope it will help make the NYPD think twice before violating the rights of LGBT people of color. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. The Department of Justice recently announced FBI agents have closed nearly half of the department's 122 investigations into unresolved killings from the civil rights era. For the first time, the Justice Department has made public a list of victims and the status of the investigations. Among the 62 cases still open is the notorious murder of three civil rights activists in Mississippi in June 1964. The Mississippi burning case is the subject of a new documentary titled Neshoba, The Price of Freedom. It opens tonight in New York at Cinema Village.
About 200 civil rights workers have arrived in Mississippi to begin a summer-long campaign. They were trained for it on a college campus in Ohio. This week, another group of volunteers is being taught what to expect in Mississippi and how to cope with it.
Okay. They are taught how nonviolently to protect themselves when attacked.
We're going down there. We're trying to face a real situation that will occur. Namely, there will be a mob at the courthouse. We also want the white students who are playing the mob to get used to saying things, calling out epithets, calling people niggers and nigger lovers.
There is some mystery and some fear concerning three of the civil rights workers, two whites from New York City and a Negro from Mississippi. Police say they arrested the three men for speeding yesterday, but released them after they posted bond. They have not been heard from since.
First, the known facts. James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner went to Mississippi to help register Negroes as voters. Cheney, a 20-year-old Mississippian, was a veteran of the civil rights movement in his home state. He assisted in the training classes. Goodman, 20, a New York college student, had never participated in the civil rights movement, but a friend says Goodman could never understand how some people could be so lacking in compassion. Schwerner, 24, a seasoned New York social worker, left Mississippi, where he had worked since January, to assist in the training school at Oxford, Ohio.
The film Neshoba goes on to document the role local Mississippi law enforcement agents and the Ku Klux Klan played in the murder of James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner.
Three civil rights workers were missing, and they had last been seen going up to investigate a church burning in Neshoba County.
It's 35 miles from Meridian to Philadelphia, then 12 miles to Longdale, where the church had been burned. That afternoon, the three were seen at the church site and at the home of its lay leader. About 2:30, they headed west toward Philadelphia.
Cheney was outside changing the tire. They had a flat, and there was Price. And when they pulled up, he said, "I'm arresting Cheney for speeding, Schwerner and Goodman for investigation."
Cecil Price, deputy sheriff, saw him and stopped him, and he takes him into the jail. So somehow, some way, the message gets out to the Klan, and then they have to organize.
Edgar Ray Killam began to kind of coordinate things that night. Kind of gathered a group of guys, had one of them go get gloves so they wouldn't have fingerprints, told them the guys they wanted were there in the jail.
By 10 o'clock, Price says he had located a justice of the peace who fined the trio $20. Price tells what happened then.
They paid the fine and I released them. That's the last time we saw any of them.
The boys were driving back from the county jail, and they started down the road toward Meridian, and they were stopped by a police car, and there would be this group of Klan people.
They arrested them and put them in Price's car.
And then turned right into a gravel rural road.
And Alton Wayne Roberts grabbed Schwerner and he said to him, "Are you that N-word lover?" And Schwerner said, "Sir, I understand how you feel." And bam, shot him. Grabbed Goodman. Goodman didn't get a word out. Shot Goodman. Cheney, by this point, obviously realizing what's going down, took off. We know he was shot by several people. They also apparently beat him.
An excerpt from the new documentary, Neshoba, The Price of Freedom. The film chronicles the 40-year struggle to hold someone accountable for the killings. Although dozens of white men are believed to have been involved in the murders and cover-up, only one man, a Baptist preacher named Edgar Ray Killam, is behind bars today. Killam began serving his sentence in 2005, 41 years after the killings. Four suspects are still alive in the case.
Today, we spend the hour looking back at the Mississippi burning killings and Freedom Summer. We're joined by five guests from around the country, including brothers of two of the civil rights activists murdered. Here in New York, Ben Cheney's with us. He was 12 years old when the body of his brother, James, was found. David Goodman is also with us. He's the younger brother of Andrew Goodman. And we're joined by the filmmaker, Mickey Dickoff, who co-directed Neshoba, The Price of Freedom. With us in Jackson, Mississippi, the award-winning journalist Jerry Mitchell of the Clarion Ledger. He spent the past 20 years investigating unresolved civil rights murder cases. And in Chicopee, Massachusetts, is Bruce Watson, author of the new book, Freedom Summer, The Savage Season That Made Mississippi Burn and Made America a Democracy. We'll break and then begin the conversation. Stay with us.
Hound dogs on my trail. School children sitting in jail. Black cat cross my path. I think every day's gonna be my last. Lord have mercy on this land of mine. We all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here, I don't belong there. I've even stopped believing in prayer. Just about due. I've been there, so I know. Keep on saying, go slow. But that's just the trouble. Washing the windows, picking the cotton. You're just plain rotten.
Mississippi Goddamn, Nina Simone. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we go back to a clip of the new documentary, Neshoba, that is opening tonight at Cinema Village here in New York City, this features the footage of the funeral for James Chaney. It was August of 1964. It shows a young Ben Chaney crying as he signs, "We Shall Overcome," and Corps Field Secretary Dave Dennis is speaking.
I feel it deep in my heart where they find the people who killed those guys in Neshoba County. You got to come back to the state of Mississippi and have a jury, all their cousins, their aunts, their uncles. And I know what they're going to say, not guilty. I'm tired of that.
I have been asked by some people to do this eulogy, but keep it quiet. When I looked out there and saw little Ben, it didn't make sense to me. You know?
Don't bow down anymore. Hold your heads up. We want our freedom now. I don't want to have to go to another memorial. I'm tired of funerals. I'm tired of it. I've got to stand up.
That was Dave Dennis at the funeral of James Chaney. It was the beginning of August, just after their bodies had been dredged up, James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, Michael Schwerner. And we're joined by two of their brothers, Ben Chaney and Andrew Goodman. Ben, well, that was many years ago. There you were, a little boy. Talk about that day and what has happened since.
That was a very sad time. I guess it was a very painful time also. It was my first experience with death, knowing that death was final. And I guess since 46 years ago, that occurred 4 years from the 50th anniversary of that event. So a lot has happened in 46 years. There's been a lot of changes made. There's been a lot of growing in this country that have taken place in 46 years. But at the same time, there's been some things that have remained the same. America, I feel, still needs to have a serious discussion about race. And for some particular reason, we're unable to do that. And we're headed 50 years from now.
You know, we got a call from from Bill Moyer's office last night, because he heard we were doing this interview. And he says he remembers this time, right? It was, I think, August 5th, mm-hmm. 1964. He was working for Lyndon Johnson. And he was the one who received the call in the White House that your brother, James Chaney, that Andrew Goodman, David, your brother, that Michael Schwerner, that the bodies had been found. Andrew, how old were you? David, how old were you?
I was 17 years old at the time. And it was an experience that I wouldn't wish on anyone, a personal loss, but it was also an astonishing realization of what goes on in the world and the country is not necessarily what appears to go on. And I learned a lot in a unusual kind of way about all the things that I learned, all the things that I was told was right, didn't happen in this case. And when I look back at it, I realize how naive I was about what goes on in the world, and that there are people in places that call themselves Americans and Christians and then kill people and do un-American things. It was a shock to me, and how I was brought up was something that I just never realized.
Right.
Well, the amazing thing was that your brother had gone down as part of Freedom Summer, along with hundreds of other folks, and this was the first—actually, the first day of Freedom Summer when they were abducted. And what did you recall what he told you before he left, and what he was doing in Mississippi?
Well, actually, there was a training session in Ohio that about 700 young people went to, mainly college students. And something happened before they were intending to go to Mississippi, Arkansas, the various places, that a church was burnt down. So they went to investigate it. James Cheney and Michael Schwerner had been in Mississippi, had set up offices there for CORE and Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And my brother was a volunteer, and they were looking for volunteers, and he volunteered to go with them and investigate it. So this was actually a couple of days before the intention of the start of the Mississippi Summer, Freedom Summer.
I think it was interesting because Andy was going to be in charge of the Neshoba County Freedom School. He was going to be working out of that church, and that's one reason why he was there, you know. Very interesting.
So your brother, James, mm-hmm. he was the African-American civil rights worker. Andrew and Michael were white civil rights workers. How scared was James? And where did you grow up? Where did James grow up?
We grew up in Meridian, which is like 40-some miles from Philadelphia. How scared was Jay? I don't know how scared Jay was. He used to travel into Neshoba County at night at high speeds. He used to go into those areas. This John was to find places for freedom schools. So he would go to the outlying areas where heavy Klan concentrated areas. Cesar Price chased him a few times during that period. So how scared was he? I believe that if when you're 20, 21 years old, there's very little fear you have. I think he understood the danger. I think Mickey understood the danger. Probably they both understood the danger much more than Andy did. But how scared were they? I don't believe that they had any fear.
Well, if you can, talk a little bit about what life was like at the time, because I think most Americans are not aware when we talk about 60 still unsolved cases of murders during the civil rights era in the South, what the level of terror was as more and more African Americans began to demand their right to vote and the response that they got from the white society.
Well, in some parts of the country, it was at with people at war. That was very oppressive. The atmosphere of fear, was strong in the air. It was very strong. And you had the Klan that would carry out this fear. And you had state governments like agencies like the Sovereign Commission that would reinforce it. They legislated fear. They legislated discrimination. They enforced it through the laws of the state. So people, civil rights workers and those who supported civil rights workers had very little recourse. There was no one to protect them, but yet and still they still did the work. You know, I remember growing up in Mississippi at one point, my brother used to take me to get haircuts. And we used to have to get off the sidewalk when white people was coming down the sidewalk. You know, terrorizing there, Mississippi was in that period. So fear was really deep, but I think when you're young and you're strong and you're healthy, I don't believe those young people who was involved in the civil rights movement, the volunteers who went to Mississippi, those that were in Mississippi that was working, they understood the danger, but I believe that deep down inside, they believed that they were so smart, so courageous, so strong, they could avoid the real danger.
Mickey Dickoff, why did you decide to do this film, Neshoba, The Price of Freedom?
In 1964, I was 17 years old, and I had wanted to go to Mississippi to register voters. And my father, who grew up in Mississippi, in a small town in the Mississippi Delta, and the only Jewish family in town, said, "You're not going." 6 weeks later, when those kids' bodies were found, it devastated me and haunted me my whole life and really helped shape my politics and my art. I didn't know that 35 years later I was going to get a phone call from Ben Cheney, who said, "Are you interested in making a film about these murders?" And I flew to New York and met Ben. And it took us a little bit longer than from 1999. We didn't really start shooting the film until 2004. But getting close to Ben and getting close to Carolyn Goodman changed my life. And I thought it was extremely important that this story get told, the truth of the story get told.
And of course, most most Americans were familiar with the story, know it from Mississippi Burning. But you centered a lot of the film on the actual trial of the only person so far found guilty of being involved in these killings. And you were also able to capture talk to the jurors as well. Talk about that experience and how open people were to talking with you about such a deep wound in the history of Mississippi.
Well, let me just say, when we started shooting this film in 2004 at the 40th anniversary, we had no idea that 10 months later Edgar A. Killen would get indicted. We actually thought we were going to make a film to try to embarrass the state of Mississippi to finally do the right thing. We actually started out following a group of 30 people from the Philadelphia Coalition, 15 whites and 15 blacks, who for the first time in 40 years decided to talk about this case and ask for some kind of justice. So we start to follow them. Also, I was very close to the families of the victims, and Carolyn Goodman was in her upper 80s. Fannie Lee Cheney was in ill health and in her 80s. And if something was going to get done in terms of some sense of justice, because obviously justice could never bring back those kids, that we wanted to do something about that. The people in town were fairly open to us, actually. And we went into very different parts of Neshoba County to really get a cross-section of the feelings, and we really wanted to get at the truth, because we really felt that the truth had been shoved under the rug, and how could these three murders happen, everybody know who did it, and nobody be held accountable.
Well, let's go to Jerry Mitchell now, a reporter for the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. You really helped Edgar A. Killen get indicted. Talk about who he was, who he is.
Well, Edgar A. Killen was, as mentioned before, a Baptist preacher, and he was kind of the organizer, Klan organizer. And so that day, what happened is, after the three civil rights workers were arrested, he was basically contacted. Cecil Price put out word to Billy Wayne Posey, who in turn got word to Edgar A. Killen, that they were in jail. The civil rights workers were in jail, and they only had a little bit of time, so they needed to act now. And so Killen then drove down to Meridian, Mississippi, gathered up a bunch of Klansmen, and they drove back to Neshoba County, to Philadelphia, Mississippi. And there they waited, basically, for the civil rights workers to leave jail. It was all part of a plan, basically. And once they were released, you know, chased them down and of course, caught them and killed them and buried their bodies in a dam. So Killen was very much kind of the organizer of that and made it happen.
And Jerry Mitchell, in terms of the why it took so long for anyone to be brought to justice in this case, how long were you writing about it before there was an indictment of at least of Killen?
Actually, I started writing about this case back in 1989. That's when I first began. It was the first case I wrote about, began writing about what evidence still existed. Wrote about the transcripts still existing and began talking to and interviewing witnesses such as Delmar Dennis and others, who unfortunately died, by the way, and of course did not testify in Killen's trial. So I began writing about it back then. Of course, what helped is the fact that I also began writing about the Megger Evers case. That case got reopened, got re-prosecuted. Byron D. LeBeck was convicted in 1994. Came back after a series of other convictions, came back to the case because I found out that Sam Bowers had bragged that while he was convicted, he was happy about it because the main instigator of the entire affair walked out of the courtroom a free man, and he was referring to Edgar Ray Killen. And that was in, my story on that appeared in 1998. And then you see how much later it was after, even after that. So it just
took, it took 6 years.
Quite a bit of prodding and,
Let's go to another clip from the film Neshoba. During the trial, Edgar Ray Killen's attorney questioned former Klansman Mike Hatcher.
Who swore you in that night, that day, night, whatever it was?
Edgar Ray Killen, Preacher D.
Did you ever hear any talk of there being an elimination of the civil rights workers?
Yes, sir, I've heard it discussed, and I didn't know the Klan would ever do anything like that. Me being a police officer.
You stated that Edgar called you out and said, we got rid of the civil rights workers. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What else did he say?
He said we wouldn't have no more trouble with Goatee. And then
he never did say that. Right. I told him I did, but said I told him we got rid of which he is a bald-faced liar there.
And he told me that he was at the funeral home, signed the book, made sure he talked to people in front and rear of him, and that was his alibi.
And my estimate was at that time that 99% of the people wish they had been the ones that got him. But there again, since I didn't do it, I never did get to play the hero and say, hey, I did it. No, no way. If those three had stayed at home where they belong, they'd have never found any home here.
And that last voice was Edgar Ray Killen's. These are some excerpts from the closing arguments in the Edgar Ray Killen case.
These acts were not sanctioned by God. They were sanctioned by that man right there, by that defendant. You know, there's an old saying in the South, you know, if done a day's work when you make a preacher cuss. Well, I figured I did a pretty good day's work on that day to make him cuss, so.
I had mentioned to you here that I had lost my emotions, but he brought a little bit back. When he got a little further than I could reach him, I almost got out of the wheelchair and my attorneys caught me. I'm trying to stay away from the word hatred, but the man doesn't have any morals.
It's a cowardly act. That was a mob that murdered those young men down there that night. And that coward's still sitting right here in this courtroom. He wants one of you to be weak and not do your duty to find him guilty of this crime.
If we don't know who killed him, how do we know Edgar's the one that planned it and orchestrated it? The real crime was the fact that he was not prosecuted in 1964.
This is nothing but stirring a simmering pot of hate for profit and cultural sluggishness. That's all this case is for. Look at all these folks sitting out here. This is nothing but a show. And try to put the state of Mississippi on trial again.
Edgar Ray Killen directed others to commit this crime, and that's what makes him equally guilty as them. Is a Neshoba County jury going to tell the rest of the world that we are not going to let Edgar Ray Killen get away with murder anymore?
Those are excerpts from the closing arguments in the murder trial of Edgar Ray Killen. I'd like to ask Jerry Mitchell, you have been crusading around these murders now for several years, for decades now. What has been the response in Mississippi of the readers of the Clarion Ledger and of your neighbors and friends to your efforts to uncover the truth?
Well, it's been mixed. I mean, the reactions have been mixed. I've had some people who are obviously happy about it, glad to see justice come even after all these years. And then, of course, I've had others who, you know, have cursed me or told me to leave it alone or even threatened me. I've had people threaten me. So it's been kind of a mixed bag.
And how about within the newspaper itself? Because obviously, before you were reporting there back in the 60s, the Clarion Ledger was part of the infrastructure that allowed, promoted segregation and backed some of these efforts. What's been the response in the newspaper?
Well, actually, within the newspaper itself has been very positive. You're correct. The newspaper back in the 60s was one of the most racist newspapers in America. But fortunately, that's changed today. We actually have an African-American executive editor, so it's a totally different newspaper than it was back then. But I've had complete support allowing me to kind of pursue these cases, which is amazing when I think about it, that they've let me do this for now more than 20 years.
We're going to break and then come back, and we'll be bringing in the author of a new book called Freedom Summer. Bruce Watson is joining us from Massachusetts, as well as continue our conversation with our guest, Jerry Mitchell of the Clarion Ledger, Ben Chaney, brother of James Chaney, David Goodman, younger brother of Andrew Goodman, and Mickey Dickoff, who co-directed Neshoba, The Price of Freedom, that's opening tonight here in New York. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Kim and Reggie Harris singing Too Many Martyrs, the song of Phil Oakes. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. And as we played that music, we did what Neshoba, The Price of Freedom, did in their film, played the list of the unsolved murders. And it's a remarkably long list. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to see that. Our guests are two of the brothers of two of the three civil rights workers whose case became very well known. Ben Chaney and Andrew Goodman are our guests, brothers of David Goodman and James Chaney. Mickey Dickoff is our guest, co-director of Neshoba, The Price of Freedom. Jerry Mitchell with us, reporter with the Clarion Ledger. Before we go to Bruce Watson, I wanted to go back to Jerry Mitchell on that list of the unsolved murders. On that day, as they were dredging up, in the days that they were looking for the three civil rights workers, they were dredging up black body after black body. These are the unsolved murders. Talk about who we don't know died and who killed them.
And that's part of the problem, is that there's really never been an attempt to go out and account for these. It seems every day there seems to be another case that resurfaces around the country. I mean, not just in Mississippi, but around the entire country. And so that's why it's important. There needs to be accounting. There needs to be, some attempt to come back and document each one of these cases, who was killed and what the circumstances were, even if justice can't be brought in these cases, because it's very important. It's like in Kansas City, there was a case, a civil rights case there that's now been reopened. Killing took place in 1970. So it's like I said, it's happening all over the country because people just haven't really thought about it, haven't been aware of it. But there were killings that took place, and people just, people disappeared in places like Mississippi and weren't heard from anymore.
And Jerry Mitchell, Ben Chaney referred a few minutes earlier to the Sovereignty Commission. Could you explain what the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission was and its role in this reign of terror that existed back in the 60s?
Well, it was basically the Sovereignty Commission was kind of part of the reason Mississippi was kind of a police state in those days. It was created, it was kind of the state's answer to the White Citizens Council, kind of a state authorized White Citizens Council. It was headed by the governor, no less. and some of those powerful lawmakers. And basically, they had one arm that was kind of like a propaganda arm. They would reach out up north in places, and they would promulgate segregation and say, send black speakers up north, pay them, and say, tell them how great segregation is and how you want segregation too. And then they had this other arm that was kind of a spy arm, where they basically infiltrated civil rights groups and were able to get that information. And they kind of shared all this information with law enforcement across the state. And of course, unfortunately, a number of these law enforcement in places like we're talking about, Neshoba County and Meridian, a lot of those guys were Klansmen. So they were literally sharing information with some of these same Klansmen who, of course, wound up being involved in the killing of these kids.
Let's go back to Neshoba. Speaking here is Rita Bender, the widow of Michael Schwerner, and Fannie Lee Cheney, the mother of James and Ben Cheney.
This case has gotten the attention it has gotten because two of the three men were right.
And it's no secret, the world's supposed to know. If it hadn't been for Mickey Swanner and Andrew Goodman, my son wouldn't have been known, wouldn't have been found today.
I think that says a lot about attitudes about race and who's important and whose mother's son matters more.
An excerpt of Neshoba, The Price of Freedom, the film opening tonight. And we are going to Bruce Watson, who has written the book just out, Freedom Summer, the Savage Season That Made Mississippi Burn and That Made America a Democracy. The significance of this summer, what these three men and so many others died for. Bruce Watson.
I think it's important that we put this in the context of the entire summer, as you said. We mentioned briefly that that this was part of Freedom Summer, but often the story of Freedom Summer is overshadowed by the murders, and it makes it seem as though the men died in vain. In fact, they were a part of an enormous and incredibly inspiring effort in which 700 college students went to Mississippi, went to the dangerous hellhole of Mississippi that summer to live with black people, to register, to live in their shacks, sit on their porches, talk to them, register them to vote when that was possible, and teach in freedom schools, dozens of freedom schools with 2,000 students, teaching them black history, black literature, things that had never been taught in Mississippi. It was a revolutionary effort. Very important not to forget that part of the story.
And of course, Mississippi was the birthplace of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, and it had in essence an impact on the national debate within the Democratic Party, didn't it?
Oh, yes, that was another part of Freedom Summer, was the Freedom Democratic Party set up as a parallel party because, of course, only 7% of African Americans could vote in Mississippi at that time, a shockingly low number, much lower than the rest of the South. So Bob Moses and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee had set up this parallel party to get people who couldn't go to the courthouse, who were afraid to go to the courthouse, to just sign a form and become members. And then they sent 67 delegates that they chose in their own parallel conventions. They sent them to Atlantic City, to the Democratic National Convention, where they challenged the all-white delegation and said, we are the rightful Democrats from Mississippi. And they waged a high-profile, nationally televised hearing in which Fannie Lou Hamer gave a stirring speech saying, is this America? Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our phones off the hook because we just want to be decent citizens? And they made that challenge trying to get seated. And, of course, LBJ was terrified there'd be a walkout, and they quashed the challenge. But they did get the guarantee, the Freedom Democratic Party got the guarantee, that there would never again be a segregated delegation seated at a Democratic National Convention, and there never was. So another victory for Freedom Summer.
Ben, how has this inspired you to do the work you do? In a minute, we want to go back to Edgar Ray Killen, who is alive and who has served a couple of years in jail so far.
Well, the inspiration, I think, came knowing that it doesn't take a lot of people to make a whole lot of change, and that's a good thing. So what we do is we form coalitions like with David, and we make change. I think what's important, I think one part of the discussion we're missing here is that what took place in the 60s was not just some evil people committing murders. It was sustained, it was sanctioned by the state government. Otherwise, these murders would not have occurred. And I think if we can draw a parallel to the Solomon Commission in Mississippi, to the COINTELPRO that was in the late 60s and early 70s, you know, people died as a result of J. Edgar Hoover. And I think that I think we need to think about America so this thing doesn't happen. It could happen again. So it does happen again on no level. We need to have, a serious discussion about race.
Mickey, how did you get Edgar Ray Killen to talk so much?
When he got indicted, there was a window of opportunity where we were offered one interview in his lawyer's office. We, of course, took that interview, and the parameters were you can't talk about the Klan, you can't talk about the murders, you can't talk about anything. And basically, it was about a two-hour interview of him saying how innocent he was. Now, filmmakers, journalists, reporters have tried to get to him for 40 years, and, of course, he never let that happen because he's got an ego that's so tremendous. When that interview ended, I knew we had an interview, we had him on tape, but we did not have the interview. And I went up to him and I said, Edgar, you know, you've never told the truth of your story. I'm a filmmaker. We want to get to your truth. He said, what are you doing tomorrow morning? We were invited over to his house, and that turned into 5 months of interviews.
Well, in the documentary, Edgar Ray Killen openly defends his segregationist views but denies he killed the three civil rights workers.
A mulatto, in reality, the family don't want him. The country don't want him. So I don't deny under any conditions that I have been a segregationist. The whites that wanted to integrate so bad was because that they wanted to live like the blacks generally did. Most of them was as immoral as you could imagine. The blacks would very openly tell you here, if you hadn't been a nigger one Saturday night, you hadn't never really lived. Just because I don't believe that the black and the white need to marry and mix and mingle all their life, social and whatnot. That don't mean I said, let's go out and shoot somebody.
I want to ask you, it's been said that he's a very charming individual, that he's very likable. And talk about that contradiction between someone who seems so charming and yet, on the other hand, can be guilty of such an inconceivable act.
That's what makes him so insidious. But you have to understand, he believes everything he says. And his ego is so big that we allowed him, because I'm sure he thought that this was an opportunity for him for the first time to tell his story. Maybe he thought he was manipulating us when we were doing this. But he wanted to tell that truth. And as we spent the months with him and it went on and on and on, he opened up more and he opened up more and he opened up more. I think the hardest part for me personally as a filmmaker, I don't think I could have done it 20 years ago. Because as I was sitting across from him and things would come out of his mouth that just chilled me to the bone and not debate him. The hardest night for me was right after Carolyn Goodman testified, and we went back, and I was trying to find some humanity in this man. Because remember, he didn't act alone. And if to say that we have justice because we put an 80-year-old man in prison doesn't really come close to justice. But maybe by telling the truth, it gives us some justice. Anyway, Carolyn had testified. This is something she'd been waiting for her whole life, and it was a very emotional testimony. So that night, I thought, he's got to feel something. Okay, and I thought, what could I ask him to see that he had some feelings for a mother losing a child? And I finally said, Edgar, I know you think that they shouldn't have been here and they were outsiders and they did all these things, but can't you feel sorry for a mother losing a child? And his response was, well, maybe if she were a good Christian. That was the hardest moment for me not to get out of the chair. But He, you know, we did exactly what we told him that we were doing, and that was telling the truth and to make sure that he wasn't the ultimate villain of the story. Because if it wasn't for the governor, and it wasn't for the sovereignty commissioner, it wasn't for all the rich white folks who patted him on the back, this could never have happened.
This is another clip of Neshoba, beginning with Barbara Cheney Daly, the sister of James and Ben Cheney, talking about Edgar Ray Killen.
They should hang him, or however they kill him in Mississippi, that's the way he should die. Actually, I'd like him buried alive and damned, if you want me to tell you. Who the hell he think he is to take somebody's life? Who died and made him God? and I would like him to tell me what made him think he can kill somebody and get away with it.
I'm not a murderer. Right now, I'm the illegal Mississippi official sacrificial lamb.
I say sacrificial goat. Now, if you're talking about sacrificial lambs, those three young men, Swerner, Cheney, and Goodman, were the sacrificial lambs.
Sometimes that's all the national news media gets here when they're being driven away. They snap the Ten Commandments, and they try to be sarcastic about it, but we feel proud that they got it. We really believe in the Ten Commandments.
There is no bigger picture of hypocrisy than the Ten Commandments sitting in front of his house. The Ten Commandments are what God is going to judge us by. There is no misunderstanding in thou shalt not kill, whether it's black, white, Jew, communist. He played God. I think he bought into his own image. And so the men in this area looked up to him. That was him in 64.
I've known him all my life. He was a friend of my father. In this part of the country, there is no misconception about Edgar Ray, except that he talks too much. But as for the world, he's been made out to be the baddest of the bad.
And that was J.D. Killen, a good friend of Edgar Ray Killen. And before that, Angela, the daughter of James Cheney, who doesn't talk about this case very much. She lives in Meridian. We wanted to go back to Jerry Mitchell very quickly to find out about the other people involved in the killing of Andrew Goodman, James Cheney, Michael Schwerner. Edgar Killen just went to jail in the last few years. What about them? They're free.
Right. Right. There are four suspects that are still left in the case. Olin Burge, who owned the property where they were buried. Richard Willis, who's a police officer in those days, and I just did a story the other day about the fact that FBI documents document that he assaulted at least a dozen African-American men back in those days. Pete Harris, who is another Klansman from Meridian, Mississippi. And then Jimmy Snowden, who was a part of the killing party that went out that night and killed these kids. So those are the four men four suspects that are still alive today. And as for me, I'm continuing to write about
it. Ben, why does this matter that these men be pursued?
Well, they committed murder. And if we don't prosecute those people who committed murder, regardless, there's no statute of limitation on murder, then we leave it open for other people to commit these type of crimes and get away with it. And the justice system has to work. We all live in America, so it has to work. And in order to make it work, we cannot let a group of people get away, God is who they are, who commit such crimes. They have to be prosecuted.
And David, even in the case of Killen, he was only convicted for manslaughter, not murder, although he got a significant sentence. But what is your sense about the necessity for everyone being who was involved, who's still alive, being prosecuted?
Well, you have to sort of go back to the time of what was going on. And the majority of people in America are white. And I thought I was well-educated at the time, even though I was 17. Of course, when you're 17, you think you know everything. But I didn't have a clue of what went on in this country in many areas. I didn't understand racism, and the majority of white people in this country didn't understand it until they were confronted, as Rita said, with two white kids getting killed, and they said, gee, this could happen to my kid. So how is that, which happened almost 50 years ago, relevant to today? We have a media that doesn't educate us, and or we aren't conscious about what's going on. We're concerned naturally about our own families, paying the rent.
We have 5 seconds.
And this is a way to learn from the past about how we need to pay attention to what's going on today.
Andrew Goodman, Ben Cheney, Mickey Dickoff, Jerry Mitchell, and Bruce Watson, thanks so much for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.